Yeah, guys, thank you so much, and thank you for staying. I know that I'm keeping you up for your from your beer, which will be quite lovely, and with a gnarly piece of software and hardware, let's say. So I'm Lily, and this is a part of my PhD work that I completed a couple of months earlier. I'm a researcher in astrophysics and atmospheric physics, and what we did with a couple of folks back in where I'm coming from, Greece, we made a miniaturized sensor that's used to measure the electric field strength in the atmosphere. And I'll show you in a bit. So a brief agenda of the presentation. So I'm going to do a bit of an intro and discuss a bit the scientific question that was posed in our minds and in our that attracted all the funding for this research to be conducted, and then why we chose open source, which is self-explanatory, let's say, for that case, the sensor assembly and a few testing bits from the sensor, some observations from scientific campaigns that we did throughout all this period, and then our data sharing platforms and what's next and what we hope from the sensor. So a lot going on here, but what I want you to keep in mind is that we're coming from a field of, let's say again, atmospheric physics, and what we were seeing throughout all the years of science is that our experimental data were showing that particles, and particularly ones coming all the way from the Sahara, dust particles, were transported all the way towards Central Europe most of the time, and or all the way from the Atlantic. So we couldn't figure out why that was happening. And we couldn't because our models and our forecasting data models couldn't depict this change. So we were hypothesizing that these particles are moving within a fairly dynamic system, which is our atmosphere, and that we have this vertical electric field that's within the entire spectrum of the atmosphere. And as they were moving within, there was some electric force, most probably, that would act on the particles and make them to, let's say, float within the atmosphere, negate the gravitational force that was acted on the particles. And then another, let's say, after effect of these electrical forces could be that it would orient the particles on the vertical direction, and that would give them even fairly more time within the atmosphere, which was another part of my research back in the PhD days. So in order to have and collect all the data that we could possibly have for our hypotheses, we needed to do some measurements from ground-based sensors, but we also needed and found that the best practice to do was to launch balloons over in the atmosphere, lower atmosphere, with atmospheric electricity sensors and acquire the data that we needed within the layers of the dust particles. So could we verify our hypothesis through the observations? And then we needed new developments in order to do so. So the only way was that, to do all these launches that I talked about before. So let's say why we went for the open source in terms of, you know, all the traditional academic structures that do not allow the scientists to form collaborations, and they not foster, many times they do not foster collaborations between open source practices. And then there's this concern in terms of the researcher personal status and recognition, and that all the open source work that's been done doesn't get recognized as it should be. And again, then there are these biased reward systems that do fog, let's say, the perception of the researchers. And what we wanted to do is exactly that, challenge and create transparency through our work. And what we found up till then concerning the specific sensors was unfortunately fairly closed. So we had a couple of projects which were depicted from publications, you know, the traditional system of the academia to present their results. And these were, for the left-hand side, they were not tested on these balloon-borne platforms that we needed them from. And they were most of the times sketchy, and there were non-existent schematics at all in terms of the sensors, which was pretty bad. And then there were some other stuff that were mostly homebrewed projects, which weren't, let's say, tethered to our applications for the measurements, or that they weren't sensitive to the electric fields that we wanted to measure. So these two on the right-hand side are both very cool projects, and we used a lot of their, let's say, bases for our projects. So again, cool ones, but not the exact one that we wanted for the data in the research field. So a few words about the sensor. We are calling it a mini-mule, which is a miniaturized version of a commercial field mill electrometer. That's what they are called. And what it actually does in the principle of operation is that you have a fan with two vanes that they're periodically screening a sensing electrode on the bottom side of the fan. And this what does is that it induces charges on the effective area of the electrode, and this time-resolved charge creates and induces an induced current. And that's what we measure with the sensor, and the internal processing and the data for the sensor are amplified, and then we get the measured voltage, which is twice the amplified output voltage from each of the coupled electrodes. For the latest version of the sensor, we were using a DC brushless motor, which was used and the speed controlled respectively in order to minimize the electromagnetic interference in our system and the circuitry. And then we also integrated gyro, three-axis gyroscope for the rotational position of the sensor. So we were trying to use as low RPMs as possible for the optimal response of the electrometer. On the right-hand side, that's the exploded view of the sensor. It was used in, we were using layers. So we have like the cover plate, which unfortunately you can see here because it's shielded by the electrode view for the PDF. And then we have the motor and the vanes that I told you about. And then we have the motor mount and the back plate, which was all cut in aluminum for sturdy purposes. And then we have the intermediate PCB with the electronics of the sensor. So it was ADC, it was controlled by an analog to digital microcontroller. And we used a serial transmission for the data. So it was all assembled in the institute with the two guys that I showed you before. And that's the final result for the sensor. It's quite a small and robust sensor, like 8 centimeters at each side. And we have used the thermal shielding because, you know, as you go up within the atmosphere, the temperature drastically falls. And we needed to shield our electronics and the battery supply. And what it does is that I said it measures the electric field strength with the altitude. So the pros for the sensor was that it was easy to reproduce. It's a fairly low-cost sensor with all its the hardware and the electronic components. It's lightweight and it's disposable, which is it's a bit of a problem because you have, you know, all these metallic parts and all these circuitry that are going into the ocean most of the times. And they are not retrievable because, you know, the cost of getting it, it's quite larger than the sensor itself. So we will jump to another version, which is going to be not biodegradable, but definitely with less metallic structures. And hopefully it will be sturdy enough for the measurements that we would like to do. And same validation methods. So on the cons, it had these bulky electronics because it was an implementation on a PhD level, and we had the minimal amount of knowledge for this for this project, but hopefully it's going to get better and better with SMDs and stuff. So what it does in scientific terms, it slightly overestimates the electric field, because as the sensor, you know, it's actually hanging from this balloon, and you have all these winds and shears that are hitting it as it goes up. So we have parasitic electric fields that can be detected from the motion of the sensor. But we are using a rotation, the rotation of the sensor, to minimize this effect. And it has, unfortunately, a limited operation temperature at minus 50 degrees. It can mostly operate at this specific version on dry conditions. So if you have like heavy rain conditions, it's going to be heavily biased in terms of the output. But that's that can be fixed easily. And it has a maximum altitude of about 16 kilometers, which was in the atmosphere again, which was fairly biased by the battery level freeze due to the decreasing temperature. So it's a sensor. You have to do all sorts of calibrations to be ready and robust for the measurements that you're taking. So we had a hard vibration test. We were actually, you know, moving the sensor around and getting the data. We had the temperature resilience test, and we tested its response with a commercial, which was well validated instrument, and they had similar responses, pretty good ones. And again, we put it on different conditions. And the most, you know, famous, let's say, setup for calibration of such sensors is that you're putting them like in two parallel plates, and you're using a fixed voltage between the plates, and you are securing the sensor in order to measure this fixed voltage that you have and to control the output. So that was the standard calibration setup. And it's also, since it's pretty small and it doesn't have, you know, all these complex aerodynamics, can be easily tethered to UAVs. We haven't completely tested that through modeling, but we know that it's viable and it can send its data. So the telemetry now, that was a bit complex because we couldn't use, we didn't have the knowledge actually to make a telemetry on our own and just pop the data down. But we also needed meteorological data from collocated with our electric field data, because that was just a single measurement, and we need other parameters also to explain, you know, this ecosystem of models that we needed to use for the forecasting. So we created another second sensor, which was also measuring its own stuff. And we desi-chained our electrometer to the second sensor and then to a commercial radio sonde. If you are not familiar with these are like small instrumentation that are flying almost every day from around Europe. And the meteorological services are releasing those balloons. And they are giving us all the data that we need within the atmosphere for meteorological parameters. So a cool stuff that was done here, the radio sonde had its own protocol, data protocol, the X-Data one. And we needed to do a bit of reverse engineering in order to connect our sensor to the X-Data protocol and then trick the ground station that was receiving the data that our sensor was actually one of the commercial ones, which was dumb, because you just was we were putting with our hands an ID and a fixed ID, and the ground station knew that was a completely different sensor and said, you know, okay, just passing through the data, that's fine. And then we created the decoder for the data, and then we have the raw output. And also, the sensor was able to measure as a standalone, but on the ground, not flying up in the atmosphere, with a serial that was giving out a simple text output. And then again, we said, you know, okay, we have one. We've made all this effort, like for a couple of months, to create one. Let's create another 30. Which was quite tedious, but yeah, but we needed that because, you know, when you research all these dynamic systems as the atmosphere, you need to have as temporally dense data sets. So we needed to launch almost every day, or maybe twice a day if we had the correct conditions. So off that, we are going to a very, very nice place, the Cape Verde Islands in South Sahara, South Africa, yeah. And we've launched there through an initiative and a campaign that we did with ESA, the European Space Agency. It was called ASCOS. It was a pretty big campaign, and it had all sorts of atmospheric stuff going on over there. It was not only that part, but we were tasked to measure the electrical conditions in the atmosphere. And some, you know, very fancy results from the first experiments that we were doing. On the plot, whatever you see, these colorful dots, these are different days that we were launching our sensors. And on the x-axis, you have the electric field strength, which is measured in volts per meter. And on the altitude, the y-axis, you have the altitude. So within these layers that you can't see but visualize here of dense dust particles, we have this increase of the electric field that we are seeing in different days of launching our sensors. And that was a pretty good win, because, you know, from this addition of the sensor, we were getting data which were quite realistic, and we were getting some hints that the dust particles were charged indeed as we were expecting. Again, we did a correlation between the wind speed and the electric field with a wavelet transform, and we saw a small anticorrelation, but that gets a bit too researchy and technical, so I'm going forward. And that was a very, very nice day for us, because we are going all the way again to Cape Verde, and that's a day that we have a pretty intense layer, dust layer. What you see with this colorful green thing over here is dust within the atmosphere. It's measured from a very specific laser, which is called LIDAR. And we also launched the sensors that day in order to see if we have this electrification of the dust particles. And it was a pretty successful one. We have many, many and lots of data from the days that we have on the campaign. And the data are also available. So the sensors for the day, let's say, were operational up to 14 kilometers due to battery decay. So we are keeping the data up to that point. So now, what do we do in terms of sharing all this work? So primarily, our repository is in GitHub. And we have also collaborated with the Evaluation and Validation Center for the data of ESA. And that's where the raw data set from the sensors and the entire campaign can be found. We also have right over here the ASCOS calendar, which shows a step-by-step process of what were the instruments used, the daily plots from the sensors, and then all the other instruments that we were having. And all the work, including all the publications done for that work, the data sets, and all the presentations, can be found in Zenodo. So please do contribute if you find it interesting. And yeah, so some long bullets, but I would like to mention that. So what were the challenges that we faced as we were conducting all these open source practices and all this research, is that we had some, you can have fairly large standardization issues. So if you have variations within the sensors and all the bulk of the sensors, there it can affect the reliability and the consistency of your collected data. So another step was to have pretty good documentation quality so that we can ensure the project success. And especially for those that were not quite familiar with the hardware. We do not have that many contributions to know if it is a good documentation, but you know, please do check the project. So also we needed to have a technical expertise, minimum technical expertise for all those that would like to assemble the sensor, or that we employ, the people that we employ to assemble the sensor. So also we have data calibration and validation that needs to be compliant with the regulations, unfortunately, of large research organizations when you're talking about research that can affect many fields and being interdisciplinary. So also we had to battle a bit with the funding constraints, which is present and limited in terms of the open source and open research projects. And we had to do a lot of testing, and also the quality control of the data themselves can be quite challenging. So also we have the ending, that's the long-term support when addressing open source hardware issues, through releasing updates of the hardware, and if that's going to be a compatible technology for the second version of the sensor. So a key takeaway is that do we answer our initial scientific question? And fairly yes, which was quite good. And the Minimule produced nice results, and we were pretty happy about that. And it's definitely not something that can be used only in research. You can build it on your own and just use it for fun if you'd like on your backyard. So in retrospect, in terms of the result that I had in my personal research is that the electrical properties do not play a significant role on the long-range transport of the particles, which was a boo. Okay, because we did, you know, all that work. But again, we had a milestone and a physical mechanism that was not accounted before in all this research. So what's next? The next step is that we want to migrate in complete open hardware technologies like FreeCAD and KiCad. And version 2 is being baked at the moment, and we would like to do it on our local hackerspace with a bunch of people that were interested. And yeah, that's more or less it from me. Thank you so much all. And that's my email if you want to address some questions apart from the ones that you're going to do now, if you have to, and my Git handle back there. Yeah, hi.
So if it doesn't turn out that electrical properties are not responsible for the transportation of desert dust, do you have any ideas or suggestions what might be?
Yeah, I do. Thank you for the question. That was one that I was expecting on my PhD defense and never came. So that's good. Yeah. A factor that I didn't, you know, quite... Oh, do I need to...
Yes,
please repeat the question. So the question was that if there are the electrical properties are not a factor that will be very crucial for the particle dynamics, if there's something else that plays a role, and if we have an idea about that. And yeah, we do. It's actually the orientation of the particles, which was the second part of my PhD that I was researching with an instrument. And we've seen that particles are indeed getting oriented in the atmosphere. And from, you know, complex modeling of the particle dynamics, we know that they're going to float a bit more from that movement alone. So, but that movement won't be efficient only by the electrical forces. You have winds, like strong updrafts that... are gonna, you know, orient the particles, or maybe do a slingshot effect and make them flow within the atmosphere. So there are pretty complex mechanisms, but that was a small milestone to that.
Maybe one more, yeah?
Yeah.
Really wanted to see open source hardware project. So in your documentation, do you also essentially, for example, document all the steps of the open hardware along with, for example, calibration and maybe maintenance and repair details?
Yes.
You said you're working on a second version. Are there any efforts, for example, to say, institute replication efforts around the world?
If there is,
Replication to essentially, as a open source hardware replication.
Yeah. It's going to be, so we have recently, to repeat the question. Yeah, I have to remember all that, you know, and my brain is jammed. So If the question was if the current documentation has, you know, all the tedious processes that we've used from the hardware documentation to the step-by-step process of calibrating the sensor and stuff. So yeah, that's correct. We have it, and the concept is to have to be able to you know, with some small steps to be able to recreate the sensor yourself. It needs a bit of, you know, CNC machining and CADing. It doesn't have 3D printing at the moment, but maybe the best strategy would be to wait for version 2, which is going to be fairly usable and much more usable, and then you can reproduce the results yourself. So the basic calibration process was the one that I showed you. We did it like in our house, and it's, yeah, you need the voltage supply and the plates, and that's more or less it. But yeah, for the purposes of the research, you need to do all the other stuff that I numbered in terms of calibration. Thank you. Yeah.
Is this kind of measurement also done in space?
Yeah, that's a nice question. The specific, yeah, is it? you want to go with the flow and just answer quickly, but that's, yeah. So are that? No. I didn't say it to say sorry. So do such kind of measurements get repeated in space? Well, not with the specific sensor, because it's pretty. Pretty bad in low temperatures. Pretty bad in low temperatures, and it doesn't have space hardened components. So the basic strategy to go to, there are like rods that are collecting particles, and these are translated to electric field measurements. When we talk about, let's say, rovers, for example, when you're going to Mars, which is actually the image that I showed here. So that's the planet Mars. And it has a fairly large global dust storm, which is pretty nasty, and it lasted for at least a couple of years. So when you're speaking for that kind of technology, that's the go-to sensors. But these were sparse. I think there was actually one mission that was successful and that landed on Mars with such an instrument that was using electric field measurements. And then apart from that, nothing. Yeah.
But also in space around
Around Earth? Around the Earth, yeah. Not that I'm aware of. I know that there are some processes of magnetic field measurements that are done with small pocket cube satellites, but I'm not aware of electric field measurements, yeah.
Because, you know, if you make the satellite 2 centimeters bigger, you have the nano satellite format, and you can, it's quite easy to get them in space.
Yeah, it's quite easy. Yeah, and I hope
and
that
they stay there all the time.
Yeah, all the time. I know. We're actually, I'm pretty close with guys that are with us in the room. They're called Libraspace Foundation, and they are using all sorts of open hardware and open software stuff to make small satellites. So it would be a nice collaboration, let's say, or yeah, he's waving. Yeah, he's doing all sorts of mechanical engineering stuff. Yeah, so it needs the objective. It needs the scientific objective. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so that's folks, I think we want to wrap up.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.